at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio for January 15th, 2014. I'm Jimmy Tardy. I got a lot to tell you, so I got to talk fast. Today, we are going to hear from friend of the show, Joe Meyer, KBOO's own Joe Meyer. We're rebroadcasting his thoughts and observations, which we recorded last year while the trial was ongoing, of Muhammad Muhammad, the young man who was cajoled and goaded into thinking he was setting off what turned out to be a fake bomb at Pioneer Square in 2010. On January 29th, we'll be broadcasting the premiere of Joe's radio drama, Mo is Shy, a fictional account of what Joe witnessed as he sat through every minute of the trial in 2013. We have music from Pink Floyd, Fearless. We have Lily Allen with The Fear, and our highlight of the podcasted episodes from the Occupy Eugene Media Group. This is Aaron G. Spears and his podcast of Mic Check. He's discussing the manipulation of fear and the Powell memo. You want to hear about this, folks. Let's go at it.
And I want lots of money. I don't care about clever, I don't care about funny. I want loads of clothes and loads of diamonds. I heard people die while they're trying to find them. And I'll take my clothes off and it will be shameless, cause everyone knows that's how you get famous. I'll look at the sun and I'll look in the mirror. I'm on the right track, yeah, I'm on to a winner. It's about film stars and less about mothers. It's all about fast cars and cussing each other. But it doesn't matter, cause I'm packing plastic, and that's what makes my life so fantastic. And I am a weapon of massive consumption, and it's not my fault, it's how I'm programmed to function. I look at the sun and I look in the mirror. I'm on the right track, yeah, we're on to a winner. I don't know.
The trial of the so-called Christmas tree bomber started January 11th, 2013 in the Marco Hatfield Courthouse at 1000 Southwest 3rd Street in downtown Portland. This is directly across the street from the Occupy camps and the very building in front of which For every day of the camps, a father marched up and down with a bullhorn crying, "Free Lumumba! Free all political prisoners! Free Lumumba!" And a boy called Nameless followed him with a drum. After more than 2 weeks of testimony, the government rested their case this past Monday, January 28th. It was already evident from the opening arguments that the facts of the case are little disputed. On November 26, 2010, the day of the tree lighting ceremony, the defendant was driven by an undercover FBI agent in a white van containing an FBI-constructed fake bomb to Pioneer Square. He did indeed follow the FBI agent's instruction and connect wires in the back of the van. He was driven to another location by the FBI agent, and following the instructions of the FBI agent, did indeed dial the cell phone that he was told would detonate the fake bomb. When the defendant stepped out of the van, the FBI rushed in and arrested him. Since the defense is presenting entrapment, the government's case has two goals: to show that Muhammad was predisposed to commit the crime and that he was not unduly influenced to commit the crime by his FBI handlers. The first week of testimony was largely a forensic look at the defendant's writings. He wrote articles for an online journal called Jihad Recollections and had email contacts with people in Yemen and viewed videos of Osama bin Laden calling for jihad. This evidence was presented to show predisposition of the defendant. The second week featured the government calling the two undercover FBI agents who had direct contact with the defendant. To protect the identity of these agents, the public was not allowed in court for this testimony and watched a video feed from a different room. These agents had Muhammad carry out several tasks, including renting a storage locker to construct the bomb, finding a good parking space at Pioneer Square, and viewing a test explosion. The government argued that these tasks showed that the defendant was actively participating and even taking initiative on the plan. On cross-examination, the defense countered that the instructions for the tasks were so specific that they showed no initiative, only compliance, and that the FBI was actively crafting evidence, always with an eye towards how things would look in front of a jury. The defense further hinted that the FBI had a tried-and-true recipe for building these cases, including what public defender Lisa Hay called the triad of evidentiary valuation: plan, justification, and long-time involvement. And indeed, the undercover agents continually hammered on these points, asking up to 8 times at a single interview, "So how long you've been thinking about this?" until they got the answer they wanted. Also interesting and revealing are the errors made by the FBI during this case. These include slips by undercover agents posing as Al-Qaeda operatives, including saying, "I feel like a kid before Christmas," and, "We don't want to support those Israelis. Since the outtakes are powerful evidence for the defense, another FBI error was leaving the tapes on after the defendant left, and these so-called outtakes played an important role. They showed the agents unfiltered and very different from how they appeared both in their undercover roles and in their roles as witnesses. On the stand, they kept saying that during the operation they were trying to give Muhammad a way out, and on the stand even managed to express sadness that he continued. While on the outtakes, they celebrated that the target took the bait and that it was too good to be true. A constant theme throughout the trial was discovery of evidence, or what evidence was allowed to be displayed to the jury, and almost every morning opened with 20 minutes of legal arguments. This happens before this jury is seated, and it's my understanding that the FBI planning meetings and debriefs will not be allowed. The so-called outtakes have an interesting status. If the undercover agents give testimony that factually conflicts what is on the outtake, then the defense is allowed to play the tape. Since the outtakes are powerful evidence for the defense, this has made for very exciting cross-examination, and the FBI witnesses have been flawless. The issue of missing FBI tapes at critical moments is also a regular theme.
Joe, you've been there for over 2 weeks now. You've been there for every minute of the trial and had a chance to do some interviews live on the news at KBOU. Thanks for encapsulating all that for us. What's some of the other aspects of the evidence presented so far that has really gotten your attention?
Well, one thing I found interesting, Jimmy, was the kind of the siloing of information. The FBI within the Bureau seems to really care about how information is shared. For example, the first FBI contact with the defendant was by a guy named Jason Dodd, and his alias was, I believe, Bill Smith. He contacted Muhammad in January of 2010, had several email contacts with him, and he was the first one to suggest doing action in the U.S. That undercover operation failed. They stopped it. They started another one. That one failed. And when the third one started, the FBI agent was able to credibly say, oh, gee, I only met with him for 10 minutes. And after those 10 minutes, he already suggested doing action in the United States.
So the attempt to get Muhammad to detonate an explosive, this event is the result of three different attempts by the FBI to get Muhammad to do that?
That's correct. Actually, the FBI had contact with Muhammad even before that. When he was 17, he started joining chat rooms and so forth with people that the FBI had investigations open with. So the FBI knew about Muhammad even when he was 17. They claimed not to have been investigating him when he was 17. But as soon as he turned 18, they sicked a couple of agents on him with email contact. And my understanding is that the FBI does this fairly regularly. I call it phishing. They send out mass emails looking for someone to respond to it. Muhammad responded one time. He got on their list.
And were all three of these efforts originated out of the local Portland office?
The first one was out of Eugene for some reason. Bill Smith was out of Eugene, and he was just he's just a fisher.
But the other two were Portland office originated attempts to get him to...
I think the second one was out of San Francisco. There was Agent Chan who was involved in that. He was the case agent for a while out of San Francisco.
Where was Muhammad at this time when they were contacting him via email?
I think he was a student at OSU at this time. He was a freshman, 18 years old.
He was doing online chats with someone. The FBI became aware of him when he was around 17. And then during his college years, he had three separate attempts to get him to do this by three separate FBI field offices. And this was all while he was in Corvallis.
While he was in Corvallis, and the defense brought up the fact that he said no to the first two times, and the FBI would not take no for an answer.
And they blame it on lack of information sharing.
Exactly. The third FBI agent, Hussein, says, oh, I didn't know anything about that. The first agent, Bill Smith, wrote that he's a conflicted youth, religiously conflicted. He's using drugs and alcohol, easily manipulable. And the agent, Hussein, says, oh, I didn't know anything about that. I was just chatting with him. I came in cold.
Okay, sure. Earlier, we were talking before we started recording, and you were mentioning about a surfeit of agents to just do a surveillance of Muhammad.
That's right. The defense brought up the case of the test explosion, November 4th, 2010, somewhere outside of Corvallis. Two agents picked up Muhammad in the morning, drove him to a test site a few hours, I think, west of Corvallis. There were already seven FBI teams there, surveillance, security, explosive experts. They even had an airplane keeping track of Muhammad's location at all times. It was interesting that it came out in the defense. I think they were prepping him to blow up the real bomb. It was also a cell phone bomb. They showed Muhammad a fake bomb. They planted a real bomb some distance away. They gave Muhammad a cell phone to detonate. The agent Hussein started going into the God is great chant. The other agent, Youssef, is trying to import the significance of the event. And the defendant, who I believe is stoned out of his mind, just as he's dialing the phone, says to Youssef, oh, wow, you got a lot of gray hair. That's really interesting, and kind of grabs his head and looks at him, just not really interested in the explosive part of it.
And yet there was over a dozen FBI agents vigilantly making sure that this quote-unquote violent jihadist wasn't just going to all of a sudden take out two FBI agents who are armed and within arm's reach of him. And this guy is such a force to be reckoned with that he's so focused that he's paying attention to how many gray hairs one of the FBI agents has.
Yeah, I would say he's easily distracted.
We were also talking about some of the requirements, the evidentiary requirements that the defense was listing. They had to establish that Muhammad had been planning such events for a period of time. Tell me more about that again.
Well, what seems to be coming out during the trial is that the government has a paint-by-numbers approach to these kind of cases, where you have to have a certain amount of evidence to proceed to the next state. And public defender Hayes called this the triad of evidentiary valuation. And she mentioned plan. There has to be a plan to commit some kind of terrorist act. There has to be a justification. And there has to be an idea of how long you've been thinking about that. And in this case, the plan was to blow up Pioneer Square. The justification was Americans are killing Muslims, women and children overseas. And I think Muhammad said he's been thinking about this since he was 15. And this comes out in the interviews where the FBI agents continually ask Muhammad these questions until he gives them the answer they want. The defense brought up that The FBI agents asked him 8 times in one interview, how long you been thinking about that, and kept on hammering on him until they got the answer they wanted.
Was he giving them different answers, or was he just distracted and not answering the question at all?
Yeah, again, I think this was the August 19th meeting, which was the first meeting between Yusuf Hussein and the defendant all in the hotel room. The scene at that hotel really is very telling in my mind. The two men are walking around, the defendant sitting on the floor surrounded by takeout cartons, stoned out of his mind, and basically directing him, alternately threatening him and praising him until they got the answers he wanted.
And it took him 8 attempts to get him to even say how long this fire had been burning in his belly to commit these acts.
That's right.
Sounds, again, like just a really focused individual here.
Was there any evidence about where Muhammad had got the marijuana that he was stoned out of his mind on?
Well, they presented text messages and email messages from his days at Corvallis, where he was buying and selling weed and using it. One text message was, I just got a gallon of vodka and a dub, LOL. Now, a dub I'd not heard of, but apparently that's a slang for marijuana.
If I understand correctly, the lingo of the kids nowadays that maybe a dub is $20 worth.
Okay.
But don't quote me on that.
Okay.
That's not a market quote price there.
Okay. So he was both buying and selling weed in Corvallis. And on the second meeting between these three, Yusuf Hussein and the defendant, on September 7th at the Marriott Hotel, towards the end of the meeting, Muhammad asked Agent Hussein, hey man, you got something to burn? And Hussein said, by all means, go right ahead, which indicated to me that not only did the FBI know he was using marijuana, but they were also indeed supplying him with marijuana. Another interesting thing about these meetings was the very first meeting between Agent Yusuf and the defendant was not recorded. This is the famous case where the recorder failed. Interesting testimony came out about that when the government called FBI agent Mario Galindo to the stand. Agent Galindo had been with the FBI since 1998, started in narcotics, and then has been a tech agent in Portland since 2002. He was the surveillance specialist in charge of wiring up undercover agent Yusuf for that all-important first meeting on Friday, July 30th, 2010. Yusuf was equipped with a transmitter as well as a recording device. The transmitter allegedly worked, allowing the FBI agent Chan to listen in and take notes, and the recording device allegedly failed. Now, on direct examination by the prosecution, Agent Galindo testified that he had tested the recording device the day before and must have accidentally left the device on, draining the battery. He reported that he first learned that the recording device failed on the following Monday, August 2nd. However, upon cross-examination by public defender Steve Sadie, Agent Galindo seemed to modify the story. He testified that the recording device was actually turned off when he put it in the case on the evening of July 29th. This is after a pointed question by Mr. Sadie that, well, doesn't it have a little red indicator light? And didn't you look at that? And then he admitted, okay, it was turned off when I put it on. And then the FBI electronics specialist suggested that the recording device must have somehow turned itself on in transit while in its plastic case.
We're also supposed to believe that the transmitted signal wasn't separately recorded.
The transmitted signal was only taken down by Agent Chan's notes.
Right.
That brings up another point. Public Defender Sadie also called into question the FBI timeline. Now, Agent Galindo knew that the recorder failed on the morning of August 2nd, 2010, and reported this immediately to his supervisor, while Agent Chan, who was listening in via the working transmitter, had testified earlier that he destroyed his notes on August 3rd because he didn't find out about the recorder failure until much later. Again, this idea of the FBI siloing information, you know, kind of a need-to-know basis, and they're able to craft kind of evidence after the fact. The story seems pretty damn incredulous, though.
Yeah, a siloing information between the agents that are working on the same case? That's absurd that they wouldn't be talking about the thing that they're working on together and how it's going in time enough for this guy to save his notes.
Agent Chan says he took all of his notes and typed them into the report, so those are luckily saved. And as soon as he heard that the tape recorder failed, he rushed to the garbage bin, and lo and behold, the notes were already gone.
Oh, so we don't have any source document to go on whatsoever.
No original source.
Right.
No original source.
Anything else about the trial jump out at you?
Well, something that's kind of important, you know, this idea of entrapment. What is entrapment? And on the first or second day of the trial, the jury asked that to the judge. The jury can send notes to the judge. The jury sent a note saying, please give us a definition of entrapment. The judge thought about this for a day and came back and said, I want you to hear all the evidence, and I'll give you a definition of entrapment with your jury instructions after both sides have rested. And I think that's really going to be a critical, critical case. I think a simple definition of entrapment is conduct by a law enforcement agent inducing a person to commit an offense that the person would otherwise have been unlikely to commit. And by those standards, there's no way this kid could have put together this bomb. He had no idea how to do it. He was led by the hand every step of the way. However, the entrapment defense in the United States has evolved mainly through case law, and there's two competing texts known as the subjective and objective tests. The subjective test has to do with the defendant's state of mind. If the guy was predisposed to do it, that's enough. And the objective test looks at the action of the government officials in terms of inducing it. Would this be something he already did? So if the judge gives kind of the first definition, only predisposition is enough, I'm not sure how the jury is going to react to that because of his jihadi writings. However, it's clear there's no way he could have put together a bomb by himself. So if the charge is trying to...
Having certain feelings, essentially. If he had certain feelings, then he's guilty.
It's a thought crime in that case. But the real crime he's charged with is attempting to detonate a bomb of mass destruction in the United States. And of course, it's hard to understand that even because the bomb never existed, really. But still, that's what he's charged with, and that's what we're up against.
Okay. That says a lot. Thanks for doing that, Joe, and thanks for sharing your observations on the trial of Muhammad, the infamous accused Christmas tree bomber from here in Portland, Oregon, who the defense is claiming has been entrapped and goaded into the actions that he took to, quote-unquote, detonate a bomb that was fake.
You mentioned earlier that it took three different agents to finally get him to agree to go along with this. Is it coming out? Are you getting any sense of how many agents in total were involved in this whole case? You mentioned before about the 14 people while they did the test bomb. It seems like a lot of expense has been poured into this.
That's also been a constant theme by the defense. The judge is not really allowing it because I guess it's not pertinent to the case necessarily, but the defense keeps on bringing up the expense by the government. At the test bomb, they had an airplane and 20 agents or something. I was surprised to see some of the logs they showed, and just when he went to his mom's house, they had a dozen agents surveilling him. I guess they take turns walking past the house so as not to be detected, but one gets the feeling that the FBI has a certain budget for this kind of terrorism or anti-terrorism, and they have to spend that money.
To justify it and get the funding again for that amount.
Seems like it.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
Mic check! Mic check! Mic check! Mic check!
Welcome on and welcome all to Mic Check Radio. You can find us online at miccheckradio.blogspot.com. Questions, comments, concerns, corrections, or suggestions, you can send those to miccheckradio@hotmail.com. You can also subscribe to the show for free in iTunes. Just search out Mic Check Radio in the podcast section. While you're there, you search out as well Occupy the Media in iTunes and subscribe to their feed as they rebroadcast the show and a host of other far superior shows. You can also find them online at occupythemedia.podomatic.com. If you're a long-time listener of Mic Check Radio, then I'm going to be jogging your memory here on several occasions. There was an episode back on April 15th of this year, 2013. It's up at miccheckradio.blogspot.com. I don't believe it's in the iTunes feed anymore. It only keeps like the last 20, 25 in there. Anyway, the episode is entitled The Powell Memo, and the Powell Memo is interesting. The Powell Memo itself is not, I don't know, widely discussed or aware of in a lot of activist circles. I mean, I did discover it through, you know, through Twitter, and I mean, I go into it in the episode. So go back and listen to that episode if you want all the ins and outs of the Pile Memo. If you'd like the 1 minute condensed version, then keep listening to this episode. The Pile Memo was written by a guy, Lewis Powell, who was going to be confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice. I mean, he had a long history of working as a corporate lawyer and basically, you know, like a shill, and, you know, worked with big tobacco and, you know, all kinds of devious in his past. And then he wrote this memo to his friend who worked as the, or worked, was the president of the National Chamber of Commerce. And in this memo, he wrote to his friend, whose name was Eugene Cinder, I think was his name, Eugene Cinder Jr. Man, my memory's working really good for me today. So he writes this memo to his buddy here, and in the memo, it's basically a checklist, it's a blueprint, it's a bullet point of how corporate America could shape politics, media, the education system, the court system, for sure. All from two guys who were heavily involved in the state as it was at that point in time, and in corporate America as well at that point in time, and it basically all came true. I mean, there may be some ins and outs that I'm missing, but more or less, it all came true. It's a blueprint for the corporate takeover of the of politics. Like I said, I mean, it was politics, media, education, courts, you name it, it's basically in there. Book publishing, textbook publishing is in there, although that's part of the education, so we'll leave that as its own little topic there. And I'm really interested in finding that sort of stuff because one of the segments or one of the aspects of Mic Check Radio that I really enjoy researching and writing and recording is I don't really have a designated topic, I guess, for it. I guess it's sort of, to steal a line from a comic book in a movie, like, who watches the Watchmen? Like, the people that are either elected or attain or, you know, just con their way into a seat of power within the state system that we have here in this particular country. I find it interesting when stuff does leak out, when stuff does come out, where it kind of, like, it shows the true nature of what we're dealing with here. It's I guess, the Pile Memo was actually almost kind of comparable to Edward Snowden, some of the NSA leaks that have been coming out in this calendar year, insofar as the stuff in the Pile Memo was interesting to read and kind of like jaw-dropping in a way, because it was stuff that, like, people that were politically aware and paying attention, activists in particular, were very well aware that's what had gone on. But to have it in the words and in the handwriting, well, it's not literally in the handwriting, but, you know, in the typing at that point in time, I guess, of the people that were doing the deeds is really interesting, and Eric Snowden and those NSA leaks are kind of a lot of the same thing. It's basically confirming what a lot of people have been talking about and had some sort of anecdotal or some actual, you know, smidgen of evidence over the course of the years. But now to have it actually, like, okay, yes, here are the documents, here's what's going on, from the horse's mouth, literally, is really satisfying and groundbreaking and phenomenal. So that's kind of in my point of view the Pile Memo. It's one of those, like, aha, you know, it's one of those documents where, like, you grab it, you print it out, you save a copy of that, you put it on your bookshelf, you know, you read it every so often, or, you know, go back and listen to the episode every so often. It's all in there. And this particular episode today we're doing is on an article from 1987 called "Perception of Risk" by Dr. Paul Slovic. And it's not exactly as damning or as much of an indictment as the Pile Memo is, but this was a National Science Foundation, you know, government grant funded study that was very well read, very well circulated, and then after 1987, which is sort of the important thing, very well referenced in further studies and in further investigations and in further publishing. It's by no means the first study of its kind, and it definitely wasn't the last study of its kind, but the way that it kind of pulled everything together previous to this on how the public, well, not necessarily the public, it's kind of on an individual scale, it's how people respond to risk or their perception of risk. I would have titled it something different. Granted, I'm reading this study years later, decades later, with a fairly cynical eye going, okay, this is actually, you know, the manual for manipulating the public via fear. And we'll get into all that in a little bit, but that's basically the idea behind today's episode, is looking at this scientific study called The Perception of Risk, published in 1987. It's one of those kind of diagnostic ones, I guess. It's one of those, like, how did we get to the society that we're at now? Like, and this is one of the, in my opinion, this is a pretty major, not step, I guess, but it's a pretty major event. It's a pretty major study that was published, that was used then in manipulating the public, as I said, via fear. Now, I wanted to kind of set the tone, because when we go back in history and look at either, like, you know, activism throughout history, or in this case, this particular time period that produced a particular scientific study, I think it's always worthwhile to kind of, like, let's take ourselves out of our current situation, you know, whoever's hearing my voice right now in their earbuds, their speakers, wherever, let's take ourselves out of whatever our current, you know, anxieties, our current fears, our current worries are. And if you weren't around in 1987, hopefully you can set a quick little, you know, kind of audio exploration of that time period. If you were around, let's try and remember it. And if you were, you know, too young to remember it, but kind of around, let's see if we can jog your memory here a little bit with a few events. Now, I don't want to spend, you know, another 50-some minutes discussing one particular topic. I don't know exactly the criteria for picking what events are major events and worth talking about and what aren't. You don't want to do just the, you don't want to do like the you know, Time Life kind of almanac of 1987, where it's just the major corporate media kind of events that they say are important. There's a lot of other stuff going on, usually in the periphery, that's actually important to a lot of people that isn't picked up on sort of a nationwide kind of news sort of scale. It's important to include those things, so those things are included in here. But at the same time, I also tried to find a few more like obscure things or really important things. Again, we're looking at this with hindsight, so stuff that happened in 1987 isn't necessarily top of the list important that year. But in hindsight, oh yeah, that's pretty important. So we're going to do a quick little journey to 1987. Don't worry, I'm not going to play a bunch of songs to try to, you know, relive the days of, you know, the 1980s, because it's really one of my least favorite eras of music and movies as well. But a few quick events, let's try to get the vibe of the times going in which this study, The Perception of Risk, was written, published, well-received, and then used, in my opinion, as a fear manual to manipulate the masses, as it were, here in the United States. And it did spread out worldwide, as we'll get into. Well, first things first, let's go ahead and say, you know, obviously, 1987, no cell phones, no email, no internet. If you're making a phone call, chances are you're probably using even a rotary phone. Some of the staple indicators that are always kind of thrown out that I think are kind of interesting: gas. Unleaded gas is running on average 89 cents a gallon. Stamps cost 24 cents. New car, the one I found online here was Ford Escort. Brand new car, $6,800. And then, you know, some of the major news stuff, like I said, you can't really overlook necessarily, but going through Wikipedia and RefDesk and a couple other places online, there's a bunch of events I didn't remember at all, but here's some of the major stuff, I guess, the touchstone things that went on there. There was a Pennsylvania treasurer named Bud Dower, who shot and killed himself during a television press conference after he was found guilty of bribery, fraud, conspiracy, and racketeering. That doesn't happen every day, or every year for that matter. I found it sort of comical in this day and age. In 1987, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed for the first time above 2,000. But then again, I guess in a bit of karma, there was also an event called Black Monday in 1987, where the New York Stock Exchange itself dropped 22%, just over 22% in one day. Also in this year, the Unabomber was still active. A second bomb, what turned out to be the second bomb from the Unabomber, explodes at a Salt Lake City computer store and injured the owner. No fatalities in that one. At this point in time, too, the Iran-Contra affair was being looked into by the Tower Commission, and they did an official rebuke of President Ronald Reagan, whatever the that means, for not controlling his National Security Council staff properly. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, finally, in 1987, approved AZT for treatment of HIV and AIDS. This was also the year of, I guess it's kind of one of those famous presidential quotes where Ronald Reagan challenged Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall, you know, tear down this wall, that whole bit of shenanigans there. In a bit of horrific war news, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas on two separate bombing rounds on four different residential areas, which was apparently the first time a civilian town was targeted by chemical weapons. So the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, this was the year that they rescinded the Fairness Doctrine, which had required radio and television stations to fairly, I'm doing air quotes there, fairly present controversial issues, which then obviously, I mean, that has an interesting ripple effect that goes through radio and television. You get the rise of the kind of pundit radio and television once 24/7 cable news is launched a few years later. There was a flight that crashed this year. Northwest Airlines Flight 255 crashed during takeoff from Detroit, killed all but one, which was a four-year-old. 156 people on board all died. ABC News Middle East correspondent Charles Glass was held by Hezbollah kidnappers in Beirut, and he escaped after 62 days in captivity. That was in August 87. The same year that Michael Jackson released Bad. Also 87, The Simpsons first appeared on television. Oh, and while we're mentioning television, since film geek that I am, worldwide top-grossing films of the year, so the most seen movies of 1987, Fatal Attraction, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Dirty Dancing was number 3, Bond's was number 4 worldwide. Good old Three Men and a Baby was a worldwide hit, so was Good Morning Vietnam, the first Lethal Weapon movie came out. Prozac, 1987 was also the year Prozac hit the market. In October of this year, there's a thing called the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which, surprise, surprise, anybody listening to this show, was a precursor to NAFTA, so that was started all the way back in 87. It was also the year of the first National Coming Out Day, which was held in conjunction with the second annual National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights. Oh, and I have a note here. Somewhere else in Texas, Brownsville, Texas, 7 inches of rain in 2 hours. The United States warships in October, it was October 19th, destroyed 2 Iranian oil platforms in the Persian Gulf. Imagine what would happen if we did that right now. This is also the year where in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the first Intifada begins in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Mega Man, the video game, the first one is released in this year. Alan Greenspan spends his first day as chairman of the Federal Reserve in 1987. And there's a couple interesting court cases that are probably worth mentioning. Made famous in the People versus Larry Flint film, Hustler versus Jerry Falwell is argued in South Carolina. And there's another court case called Edwards versus Aguilard. I might be pronouncing that one wrong, in which the idea in this court case was that creationism must be taught with evolution law. It's decided that's unconstitutional in the Supreme Court. So creationism versus evolution was very much a thing in 1987. In fact, it got to the Supreme Court and was ruled that was unconstitutional that you had to teach it. So it's almost kind of its own weird comparison to the fairness doctrine going on in the school system right there. Hopefully that wasn't too much of a scattershot. No, I'm sure it was a scattershot attempt at capsulating an entire year's worth of events into just a few minutes there. But just to sort of set the stage for this article, this study, Perception of Risk, and the climate in which it came out in, mainly the idea is that it's not terribly different from the era in which we find ourselves right now. Because I would argue that the things that are mentioned in this article that we're going to get into right now, were written in for a reason, and it keeps people in sort of a fear-based citizenry rather than an engaged and educated citizenry. So again, it's a government-funded study in which, just in the abstract, it points out, this research aims to aid risk analysis and policymaking by providing a basis for understanding and anticipating public responses to hazards, improving the communication of risk information among lay people, technical experts, and decision makers. This work assumes, and we're going to get into how many times the word assumes is used in this study, assumes that those who promote and regulate health and safety need to understand how people think about and respond to risk. Without such understanding, well-intended policies may be ineffective. Well, I'd argue that that's a gigantic assumption, that those in power are going to promote and regulate a health and safety need and keep a line of communication open with the general public, and also that there's well-intended policies being enacted at the national political level in this country, specifically now, and also specifically apropos to 1987. And so, again, just to go back to the beginning of the episode real quick, putting on the anthropology glasses here, looking at this from just a human behavior kind of base level, which is exactly how it's worded in a lot of this study. It starts off right from the first sentence. Once you get past the abstract, the ability to sense and avoid harmful environmental conditions is necessary for the survival of all living organisms. Survival is also aided by an ability to codify and learn from past experience. Humans have an additional capability that allows them to alter their environment as well as respond to it. This capacity both creates and reduces risk. It's also really worth noting that just in the abstract there, they're talking about the lay people, the technical experts, and the decision makers as three different people. I think there's a lot of overlap there. I think there's a lot of decision makers, mainly just because I watch a lot of C-SPAN or listen to a lot of C-SPAN. A lot of the decision makers are lay people, and actually I would say probably intellectually even below what this study defines as lay people.
I mean, when I say below them, I mean, you know, intellectually speaking, you have an interesting point that they make within this article, actually right here within the opening, that there are elusive and hard to manage qualities of today's hazards that have forced the creation of a new intellectual discipline called risk assessment. So then the presumption then is that within this rigorous intellectual discipline of risk assessment, that is the those are the technical experts, and to a degree, I guess they're saying the decision makers, not necessarily the lay people. These risk assessment professionals, these in this intellectual discipline, they're there to, like, you know, help out us lay people and aid in identifying, characterizing, and quantifying risk for the lay people. And then it also says that, you know, with most citizens, which they're using, you know, the term lay people here in this study, it mentions that complex technologies, be it, you know, chemical, nuclear, are pretty unfamiliar and also incomprehensible to most citizens, and that then we as lay people don't necessarily have the intellectual capability to know what the risks actually are. I'm looking for a certain line here. So, the majority of citizens, the lay people, rely on intuitive risk judgments, typically called risk study, which we're getting into here, is the idea that those perceptions are, you know, either unfounded, mainly because, as we're talking about chemical and nuclear threats specifically, or those risks specifically, that they're difficult to assess because they have, they're kind of a delayed and the consequences are delayed from specific accidents that, and then that, how that alters the perception of risk that the lay people are experiencing. Which actually is summarized here, here's a good one for you. For these people, the lay people, experience with hazards tends to come from the news media. The dominant perception for most Americans, and one that contrasts sharply with the views of professional risk assessors, is that they face more risk today than in the past, and that future risks will be even greater than today's. Similar views appear to be held by citizens in many other industrialized nations. These perceptions and the opposition to technology that accompanies them have puzzled and frustrated industrialists and regulators, and have led to numerous observers to argue that the American public's apparent pursuit of a zero-risk society threatens the nation's political and economic stability. That is a gigantic statement, which feels very real, though, that the never-ending pursuit of the American public's desire for a zero-risk society threatens the national political and economic stability. When I was first reading this article, this study, that's what really grabbed my attention, because what it's saying is this uninformed, like, lay people, general citizenry, wants to have, you know, no risk, the least amount of risks possible, but that's just not possible. And in the pursuit of this zero-risk society, the nation's political and economic stability is very much in danger, and this cannot be allowed. So it's my argument that the rest of this article then, and the bullet points we're going to go through, the three or four here, it's really a blueprint for how to manage this perceived risk of the general public. I would say, well, they use the word manage. I would say manipulate, propagandize, whatever you want to call it. Which, just to interject a bit of a personal opinion here for a second, it's kind of an instinct that I've noticed, because I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old at the house with me that we're raising, and that both of those, your instinct when you see, like, a 3-year-old out anywhere in the world with you is, you know, that instinct of protection. You don't want harm to come. You don't want to see your kid, really, no matter what age, like, you don't want to see, like, your kid, you know, emotionally hurt, physically hurt, in peril and danger. That instinct definitely kicks in there, and, you know, how you mitigate that and then coach or parent, it says something about, you know, you as an individual. But that I think that does reflect upward to this whole, you know, big brother kind of state, controls everything, protects everyone, is in charge kind of thing. And, you know, so that I kind of do agree that the idea of pursuing a zero risk society probably isn't, I wouldn't say it's, I don't really give a shit if it's political and economically stable. It's more that it's unattainable. It's just not going to happen. You can't always avoid risk. So you kind of just mitigate it as best you can. There's a quote within this particular study from Dr. Wadowski. How extraordinary. The richest, longest-lived, best-protected, most resourceful civilization with the highest degree of insight into its own technology is on its way to becoming the most frightened. Is it our environment or ourselves that have changed? Would people like us have had this sort of concern in the past? Today, there are risks from numerous small dams far exceeding those from nuclear reactors. Why is one feared and not the other? Is it just that we're used to the old and are some of us looking differently at essentially the same sort of experiences? Which I think that directly parallels what Dr. Slovic here wrote just a moment ago that we were reading, that there, the for the most people, for most of the lay people, for most of the citizens, hazards tend to come from the news media, even back to 1987. Like it's a comparable news media, although it's not as thoroughly saturated as it is right now. But they would thoroughly document any mishaps, any threats occurring throughout the world. But as in that other quote from Dr. Wadolfsky here, you know, that wasn't about, you know, this dam or infrastructure that's crumbling. It was, you know, the big nuclear reactor meltdowns. It was Three Mile Island. It was Chernobyl. It was these kind of big splashy things, not necessarily the actual things that might happen within your own actual neighborhood. So at the end of his introductory paragraph here, Dr. Slovic mentions that if successful, this research should aid policymakers by improving communication between them and the public, by directing educational efforts, and by predicting public responses to new technologies, events, and new risk management strategies. So that's the idea of this particular bit of research that we're getting into, which is sort of interesting. It ends up looking to me like a template for just the manipulation of our public fear. Anybody remember that color-coded chart that was introduced right after 9/11 that would tell us, you know, how afraid we should be on the fear scale? Any particular holiday you're going to travel, or anytime Bush and company in this country, you know, were getting a little bit of heat politically, all of a sudden the chart would go up. I mean, it's pretty well documented, and it's pretty well established and published that it was definitely, that chart was definitely used for political reasons. This study, he goes on to acknowledge that our current understandings as of 1987 on risk perception come from geography, sociology, political science, anthropology, psychology, a whole host of different fields kind of come together to kind of document perception of risk and fear, basically, is what we're talking about. Now, keep in mind the way that fear and news can go about today, as I'm reading you this quote from 1987. Response to hazards is mediated by social influences transmitted by friends, family, fellow coworkers, respected public officials. In many cases, risk perception may form afterwards as part of the ex post facto rationale for one's own behavior. You downplay certain risks and emphasize others as a means of maintaining and controlling the group as a whole. Which, as a tie into that, he kind of goes into this idea of media manipulation of risk perception. This is within the psychology section of study here. Psychological research on risk perception, which is sort of the main focus, like I said, of this segment that's coming up here, and some major developments in this area have been the discovery of a set of mental strategies or heuristics that people employ in order to make sense of an uncertain world. Although these rules are valid in some circumstances, in others they lead to large and persistent biases with serious implications for risk assessment. So basically you're misinterpreting the risks here. And since there's difficulties in understanding risk perception because there's biased media coverage, misleading personal experiences, and the anxiety generated by life's gambles, they cause uncertainty to be either denied or risks to be misjudged, and judgments of fact to be held with unwarranted confidence. Experts' judgments appear to be prone to many of the same biases as those of the general public, particularly when experts are forced to go beyond the limits of available data and rely on intuition. I mean, that is, in a nutshell, like the entirety of television and news punditry right now, where, you know, you can tune into any given news channel, say, in the wake of the Boston bombings, for example. Like, nobody on the news knew who the suspects were. I mean, it was speculation for days and days after that happened. So what does that do to the public perception of fear or risk, I guess, in the terms of this study, after an event like that happens where all the public is going, especially people who are news junkies and they're just watching this stuff and reading this stuff and checking in 24/7 about, you know, what are the newest developments? You've got several days of miscalculated experts and biases and judgments and wrong turns before there's even any actual information divulged in this case. It kind of keeps going with this idea of mental strategies used by the general public and how they can go wrong. It goes into, disagreements about risk should not be expected to evaporate in the presence of evidence. New evidence appears reliable and informative if it is consistent with one's own initial beliefs. Contrary evidence tends to be dismissed as unreliable, erroneous, or unrepresentative. When people lack strong prior opinions, the opposite situation exists. Presenting the same information about risk in different ways, for example, you know, mortality rates as opposed to survival rates, completely alters the people's perception, perspectives of risk, and then the actions they will take. So basically, yeah, evidence means nothing to the well-feared, you know, individual. The individual really full of fear and really scared. My brain, when I read that, immediately went to the whole climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it, the whole denier aspect to that. Overwhelming evidence, both right in front of your eyes and any place you want to read it, but then, you know, still, yep, it's not not part of my own initial beliefs and my biases, so that information gets tossed out the window. So that's basically the diagnostic section of this study that they're publishing, where it's sort of, you know, how the public can perceive risk. Can it be managed? Can it not be managed? Inherent biases, you know, response to hazards. It's sort of the quick psychological sketch of how the general public is going to perceive and react to risks and how they're going to manage their fear, or how the fear and the risk perception can be managed if done properly. Let's just skip right to the conclusion, which is a couple choice quotes to end on here. Risk perception research paints a different picture, demonstrating that people's deep anxieties are linked to the reality of extensive, unfavorable media coverage. And again, we're talking about 1987, where the media coverage, mostly television and newsprint at this point in time, radio to a degree as well, I guess, you know, wasn't 400 channels, it wasn't 9 different 24/7 news channels. Fewer news channels, fewer news outlets were reaching more and more people. So unfavorable media coverage really had, it seems like, a more potent effect back in 1987. I could be wrong about that. They conclude with attempts to educate or reassure the public and bring their perception in line with those of industry experts appear unlikely to succeed because of the low probability demonstrations of safety in order to assuage their fears. So you've got, what have we got since 1987 then? You've got more and more and more types of media coverage, arguably watched by fewer and fewer people. And the idea that attempts to educate or reassure the public to bring their perceptions in line really probably aren't going to work out according to plan, because people are going to, you know, they're going to veer right when you're telling them to veer left. You know, they're going to, you know, their own inherent biases that are really hard to predict. There's all kinds of factors in which they're basically saying it's going to be really difficult to sit people down with cold, hard logic, facts, you know, science, physics, whatever, and explain that that's actually not that risky. This is actually really, really risky, and appealing to reason isn't necessarily going to work. So it seems to me that the way that they, meaning, you know, people in state power, the media, the corporate media specifically, they went a different direction. So instead of going an education of the lay people, of the citizenry route, it went more put in the hands of the experts, and instead of trying to cold, hard logic and science explain things to people as we're going along here with our civilization, let's just figure out an easier way to do that. Oh, the easier way to do that would be just to manipulate the fear and the perception of risk. As always, keep in mind, the job for revolutionaries is not to take up the gun, but to engage in the long, hard work of publicizing and understanding of this society. See you all in the streets. When I say power to, y'all say the people. Power to, power to. When I say power to, y'all say the people. Power to, power to. We'll be right back.
Just wait a while for the right day. And as I rise above the tree line and the clouds, I look down, hear the sound of the things you said today.
Thanks for listening to Occupy Radio. I'm Jimmy Tardy. You just heard from Pink Floyd, Fearless. Tonight we also heard from Occupy the Media's Mic Check. That's by Aaron G. Spears, part of Occupy Eugene Media Group's podcast. We heard from Lily Allen and KBOO's and Occupy Radio friend of the show, Joe Meyer, talking about his experience of attending every minute of the three-week trial of Mohammed Mohammed, put on trial in January of 2013, a year ago, found guilty of attempting to detonate what turned out to be a fake bomb supplied by the FBI. He was convicted and has recently had his sentencing put on hold for reasons that aren't completely clear, but may have to do with the fact that part of his conviction was based on evidence gained through FISA courts. On January 29th, we will be airing the premiere of Joe's radio drama, Mo is Shy, a fictional account of what he witnessed during that trial. For Occupy Portland, I'm Jimmy Tardy. Thanks for listening. And remember, this is your home, occupant.
The time is 7:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Next up, Occupy Radio. I mean, rather, Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kboo.fm/MLKBreakfast2014.
Mo is Shy, the KBOO docudrama based on the Portland Christmas tree trial, airs this January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. Here's Ken Jones as Prosecutor Evan Bishop.
On November 26, 2010, the day after Thanksgiving, thousands of American families attended the Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Portland's Pioneer Square. Little did they know that this defendant had been plotting and scheming for several months to murder them all.
January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio.